I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, stories from the NPR archives that give a whole new meaning to the expression cutting edge.
Rapping is no longer just a slang term for talking. It's now a musical genre.
That's right. It's time to get down with your bad self, because it's November 1983, and rapping is now a musical genre. We'll hear it from the man himself, Melly Mel of Grandmaster Flash. And in November 83, Jesse Jackson announced his historic bid for the presidency, a move that inspired reaction from around the country.
I think it's time for a black to run. He's qualified.
We'll have Jackson's story from NPR political correspondent Linda Wertheimer. And other news that'll make you wonder what decade you've landed in. Like this one about a guy making calls from his car.
He's among the first 1,500 customers to use a new mobile phone system called Cellular.
Yes, you too can own one of the first cellular phones. It's easy. All you need is $3,000 and a transmitter the size of a small suitcase. We'll have that story, and if you want to hear something really funny, we've also got comedy from a bunch of crazy Canucks.
Sid Dither stars in An Officer and a Gentile, next month on SCTV.
We'll have a full report on SCTV, the odd comedy show that launched the career of a good handful of Canadian comedians. John Candy, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, and the Schmengi brothers. So let's hear it for November 1983. And to the way we used to celebrate Thanksgiving, you know, good times. When we bought our turkeys, and they still had feathers and heads and several feet. Here's author Jim Quinn with the story of what his family used to do to the unsuspecting bird.
She took the feet off, pulling the tendons out of the leg, and we were allowed to have the feet to play with. So you could walk around the house pulling on the tendons, and the feet of the dead turkey would open and close in a kind of horrible manner. And this, I have four younger brothers, so the two oldest of us would get the feet, and we would go around and terrorize our younger brothers with this. I don't think they were really frightened of it, but they realized that what we were doing was kind of older brother stuff. And it was very important to them to respond in an ordinary kind of way that younger brothers respond, which is a cry of inarticulate, heartfelt, and perfectly understandable rage.
Okay, so that was one way to have fun. But the traditional American Thanksgiving holiday still puzzled Jeremy Bowen, an NPR intern from England. He couldn't get a handle on what Thanksgiving really meant. So he took to the streets of Washington, D.C. to find out.
I started my quest at the logical place, right here at the office. But nobody at NPR could give me a straight answer. One helpful soul did say that Pocahontas and the Indians are the key. Find out about them, he told me, and you'll have cracked it. I started at the White House. In England, we always tell American tourists to ask a policeman. So I tried the same trick.
We're government employees, and we are not allowed to speak to the press.
Even about Thanksgiving?
About anything.
But I wasn't put off. In the best, fearless traditions of journalism, I pressed on, undaunted, to the Washington Monument and asked the first person I saw.
You know, when I go out of the country, like to Mexico that I've been, I come back and I see my flag and say, oh, it just touches me.
Yeah, and when you think of Thanksgiving, do you think about it in the same way?
Oh, yes, because that's a great day to celebrate, you know, Thanksgiving for our nation here.
So you're celebrating America?
America, right.
Patriotism like that is too much for a foreigner. I retreated to one of downtown Washington's leading watering holes in search of a nice, warm glass of English beer. They didn't have one, and it quickly became obvious why.
Actually, what it was a meeting once a year where we could get together to try to figure out how to kick the British out of our country.
Still thirsty, and by this time confused and hurt, I dragged myself back onto 19th Street, which is where I remembered NPR's advice about the Indians and Pocahontas.
Do you know about Pocahontas?
Who?
Pocahontas.
Do you know where they are?
who was Pocahontas?
She was an Indian princess. And the only thing I can remember about the story is that John Alden was asking Pocahontas if she wouldn't like to marry John Smith.
Now, hang on. Now, John Alden, who is that?
Well, now, wait a minute. Alden is the one that she was talking to.
All right.
And she was interested in John Alden. And
so much for that approach. I tried someone younger.
Well, the pilgrims went over to, like, America, and they found Indians. And the Indians,
they helped them learn how to grow stuff.
The Indians helped them learn how to grow stuff.
But no matter how much people got the story right or confused, I find that Thanksgiving really did mean something to everybody I talked to.
Can you tell me about Thanksgiving?
Sure.
What's the story?
Well, Thanksgiving, I think, is a time for people to get together. Family, basically. It's a very family-oriented holiday. It's very traditionally American. I think Thanksgiving is a really warm time. It's a time of loving and caring. Sort of like Christmas. The good spirit of giving is there, giving thanks.
And with feelings like that, Pocahontas notwithstanding, Thanksgiving doesn't seem such a bad holiday. But no wonder. After all, the Pilgrims were British, weren't they?
I gotta fact check that one, but I think that sounds right anyway. Early in November of 1983, Jesse Jackson announced that he was making a bid for the White House. He was the youngest Democratic candidate, the first African-American man in history, and, by all accounts, the best speaker in a group of seven other Democratic nominees. Here's a report from NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Jesse Jackson considered the step he takes today for many months. From his vantage point as head of Operation PUSH, a black self-help organization based in Chicago, he looked at the political role played by blacks in the 1982 midterm congressional elections. He found that in states, particularly in the South, where President Reagan's margin of victory was narrow, there were enough black voters unregistered who, had they voted, could have changed the outcome. This summer, Jackson took that message to the Democratic National Committee meeting in Detroit.
He won by a perverse coalition of the rich and the unregistered. The unregistered cannot register unless we break the anti-voter suppressant. If we can release blacks to run statewide and run for every office, we stimulate voter registration and participation from the bottom up.
During the course of the summer and fall, Jackson traveled the country with his message to register and vote. And he heard the message from black supporters in many parts of the country, choruses of "Run, Jesse, run." He consulted with black leaders, many of whom tried to convince him not to run. Among established black leaders in Democratic politics, there is a view that since Jackson is extremely unlikely to win the nomination, he might bleed away votes from the most liberal candidate, Walter Mondale, and help to elect a candidate who would not be closest to black concerns and causes, possibly John Glenn. But by this fall, Jackson apparently made his decision that all that weighed in the balance going into the race would do more for causes he cares about than a decision not to run would do. Jackson said so at a news conference this week.
I submit to you that at this point, with the Democratic vote being split eight ways, no one can say with any degree of authority who will win the Democratic nomination. What we can say with a measure of authority is that my presence will assure that the issues fundamental to poor people will no longer be ignored among national priorities.
Jackson also said he expects to do well in the round of southern primaries and caucuses which come early in the election process. To gain momentum there, that he expects to get votes from white Democrats even as white candidates have had support from black voters. Organizations active in registering black voters, like the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation, estimate there are about 17 million black people eligible to vote in this country. Around 10 million of them are registered. Programs set up around the country have the ambitious aim of registering an additional 2 million new voters. If they come close, those voters could very well make a major contribution when America chooses its president next fall. Jesse Jackson's way of putting it when he calls for blacks to take part in that decision is, "Hands that picked cotton are going to pick presidents." I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Here are some reactions to Jesse Jackson's candidacy from the residents of Watts in Los Angeles.
We need more black people in office than all these white folks.
You know, he's black, of course. You know, that's what black people need is a black leader.
I think it's time for a black to run, brother. It has been pushed back into a later date. And the time, why not? He's qualified.
I don't think it'd be possible that he would win.
Yes, I'm going to vote for him. Give it a try.
In other words, I would like to see him, you know, get up and at least try to run if he make it or don't make it. But I think I would rather go for Mondale.
Of course, I wouldn't vote for him even if I did. It wouldn't help.
Me, myself, being a young person,
You know, he will inspire me to vote, and I think that most of the young people will vote.
In this year's historic presidential election, 9 million people registered to vote for the first time. For an in-depth analysis on how they voted, go to npr.org/politics. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. Of the almost 9,000 radio stations in the U.S. in the fall of 1983, only about 300 were owned by African Americans. George Ware, the executive director of the Black Music Association, found that this disparity had an effect on the way black music was programmed on radio stations. He talked to NPR's Bob Edwards.
Basically, white radio in America plays music according to the color of the artist rather than the sound of the music. I would submit for proof of that groups like David Bowie, Hall & Oates, Men at Work, Talking Heads. These groups, all of their music is derived from R&B music. And yet they are played on stations which claim to be rock stations, which claim to be top 40 stations. The music is basically rhythm and blues music.
Ware says that many of today's top white artists perform music that is based on a black musical tradition. Many of these white performers use black arrangers and sidemen, and often even release cover version of old R&B hits. Others, such as Hall & Oates, have captured the sound in their own compositions. Yeah.
Of black stations, you will find these artists among the top 10 R&B artists. Put on your red shoes and dance the blues. Let's dance to the song they're playing on the radio. Of course, David Bowie's new album, Let's Dance, was produced by a black performer and producer named Nile Rodgers, who has a group called Sheep.
But you're saying that the blacks aren't crossing over to the white stations.
That's right. In other words, there's an enormous fusion movement taking place in music. That's a very beautiful movement, except that the black artists are not allowed to participate in it except on the creative side, is that they give impetus and a catalytic force for the new music, but they are not heard along with the new music artists.
Now, there are a few exceptions, right?
Certainly. Michael Jackson is the number one artist on earth today. But I would like to say that in the middle of all of that, MTV resisted playing Michael Jackson because it was alleged that his music didn't fit the MTV format, which is just an example of, even in the middle of a super hit, and with an artist like Michael Jackson, who by this time should be accepted as really a pop artist, still has to struggle through format arguments to get played.
On video.
On video.
Hard to believe Michael Jackson couldn't be a video performer. Well, now, what's the cause of this? Is it a commercial consideration, or is it just blatant racism?
Well, I say that it's because of color, even though radio programmers will tell me that what they're really doing is responding to a reality, which is that if they play too many blacks on the radio, that the whites will turn away from the station. I maintain that that's an allegation which has never been proven, because many of the listeners, I mean, nobody's playing the black artists, so how do we know whether people will turn away or not? Those same communities or same demographic groups go to watch almost all black football teams and basketball teams play. They don't seem to have much trouble unless the teams lose. So that I'm not so sure that white America is racist with respect to its musical taste. I suspect that the programmers have their own opinions about what music is, and that they are primarily... You take those opinions and use them to dictate what we hear.
93 KYS.
This is Chuck Davis, got the Mary Jane Girls, all about boys and what boys like. And you know what boys like. And if you don't, that is why you're watching Dallas on a Friday night.
That was George Ware talking to NPR's Bob Edwards. I know what boys like. I got what boys like. And if you were home alone watching Dallas on a Friday night in 1983, you probably could have benefited from the book American Couples, which revealed that when it comes to relationships, men and women don't act anything alike. Here are authors Pepper Schwartz and Philip Bloomstein talking to Susan Stamberg.
It showed me some distressing, I suppose, in this day of liberation for everybody, lasting differences between the sexes. And let me run through some of my observations and as to what women turn out to be on the basis of your statistic. And stop me if I'm wrong, or clarify, qualify it. Most women seem to dislike being dominant. This was true, yes, in the homosexual communities as well as the heterosexual.
Yes, equality, it seems to be what women strive for. And the notion that the women's movement is all about women trying to dominate their relationships, and particularly their men, we don't have any evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. Most women dislike initiating sex.
They're not used to it. Men get flattered, and they like to feel that they're sexually desirable, and they want their partner to initiate some of the time. But one reason women don't do it as much as men want to is because if they overstep that equal, then they really get punished.
Heterosexual women often describe to us the delicacy of their initiation because of what they perceive, either rightly or wrongly, to be what they call the frail male ego.
Well, how did the homosexual women work this out if neither one is willing to do the initiating?
They have a lower sexual frequency.
They do, don't they?
And we think that's one of the problems because they don't like a lot of the traditional male aggressiveness. They're reevaluating how to have equal roles in the society, but neither one of them is used to that particular responsibility. Hmm. Often it happens less because no one wants to take it on.
You said that the lesbians have the least sex. Who has the most sex?
Certainly, if you look at couples who have been together for very long, the married couples are the long-distance runners.
And long married couples
and
remain
marriage.
The long
yes,
distance
yes,
runners, I mean, which was a surprise to you.
Yes,
wasn't
we found
it?
That couples have been together over 10 years. Almost 2/3 of them were having sex at least once a week.
And there's another thing which has both a good and a darker side. There is a drive for equality. There is much, much more of a wish and many more people doing it to try and keep things equal, to try and keep things equitable. The problem with that is sometimes it gets to a very ungenerous state, which means you take care of yourself, I take care of myself, and too bad if it doesn't work out for you. And that's the danger that can start making couples not what we really have wished them to be.
University of Washington sociologists Pepper Schwartz and Philip Bloomstein, authors of American Couples.
So even if men and women weren't on the same page when it came to relationships, at least it was getting a little easier to communicate. Here's a report from Linda Wagner on the birth of the cellular phone.
When I reached insurance salesman David Meilhan the other day, he talked to me from the driver's seat of his car. When he called me back, he extended his right arm down to the touch-tone phone. He entered the number, which appeared on a small digital readout screen, then pushed a button marked send. He picked up the receiver, which he calls a headset.
I can dial the phone number while the headset stays in a stationary position. And I've actually got a speaker in the car, and I've got a microphone in the car. So if I wanted to, I could put this headset down now and talk to you over the microphone. Hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
It's essentially a speakerphone in the car.
David can direct dial to any number or receive calls from any number in the world. He's among the first 1,500 customers to use a new mobile phone system called Cellular. David's old mobile phone used a party line system. Only 12 people in a 50-mile radius could use the system at once because only 12 radio frequencies were available. Then calls were routed through one central high-powered transmitter. But in the late 1970s, Bell Laboratories tested a new system. The Chicago metropolitan region was divided into smaller areas called cells, each with its own low-powered transmitter. They were joined by a new technology, computerized electronic switching.
As you drive from one cell to the other, the call is automatically handed off from one radio antenna to the other, and you've got a clear signal from the most northern part of our service area down through the most southern part of it.
Paul Gudonis is a marketing vice president at Ameritech Mobile Communications, currently part of AT&T and soon to be a division of Ameritech Incorporated. The company provides the cellular service to mobile phone users. Under the old system, the 12-channel restriction meant that only about 1,000 people could be mobile phone consumers in Chicago. With cellular technology, the market seems wide open.
We're in the process of adding more capacity, which is one of the beauties of the cellular system, is that as you want to bring on more customers, you can construct additional cells.
Paul Gudonis of Ameritech Mobile Communications. David Mylon paid $3,300 for his cellular phone hardware. That includes the phone, a transmitting box the size of a small briefcase that fits into his trunk, and the wiring charges. The average cost of service is estimated to be $2,000 per year.
The cost of the phone is not cheap. It's not like putting a phone in your house, but what it boils down to is it's cost effective. I'll be able to utilize what really amounts to dead time. When you're driving in your car, there's not much you can do. You can't write letters.
David says the mobile phone is valuable to him as a business person who spends a lot of time on the road. For others, he says, it would be purely a luxury item at its present cost. David also points out that mobile phone service is most cost efficient when you make a lot of short calls rather than a few long ones. The service is now fully in place in metropolitan Chicago, where Ameritech may face competition in the coming year. By the end of 1984, cellular mobile phones will be operating in New York, Detroit, and other major American cities. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Wagner in Chicago. Hey!
For more stories about technology, go to npr.org. Jenna, Jenna, who can I turn to? You give me something I can hold on to. I know you think I'm like the others before. Who saw your name and number on the wall? Danny, I got no number. I need to make you mine. Danny, don't change your number. 867-5309. 867-5309. 867-5309. 867-5309.
The ultimate choice. This is SCTV.
What was SCTV? Well, it was a comedy show produced in Canada about a mythical, highly dysfunctional TV network that produced cheap and bizarre programming. As a natural byproduct, SCTV also produced a handful of comedy stars. Here's a report from John Kalish, who traveled to Toronto to experience SCTV firsthand.
Okay, here we go. Places, everybody.
SCTV is an outgrowth of Toronto's Second City Theatre Troupe, which in turn is a satellite of the original Second City Group in Chicago. The TV show was taped at a sprawling studio and office complex in an industrial section of Toronto. In addition to the four actors who appear on camera, a small army of video technicians, makeup artists, and stagehands works long hours to put this off-the-wall station on the air.
Practically everything in this room is 100% polyester.
Jule Holmeyer is the show's costume designer. Among his many tasks is the job of finding size 56 leisure suits for the portly John Candy.
I think we probably do more sleazy characters than anybody else.
Edith Prickly, the station manager of SCTV, is played by Andrea Martin. Prickly favors loud makeup and 50s-style leopard skin outfits.
Hello! Just take the old records off the shelf. I'll sit and listen to them by myself. The old music ain't got no soul.
SCTV loves to lampoon TV talk shows. Eugene Levy plays an obnoxious comedian named Bobby Bittman, who appears regularly on the station.
Sid Dither stars in An Officer and a Gentile, next month on SCTV.
SCTV often mixes characters from different historical periods, or characters who in the normal course of events would never have anything to do with each other. In the new season, Jack Benny meets the Three Stooges, Pope John Paul greets Mitch Miller, and the polka-playing Schmenge brothers go new wave.
Hello, I'm Yash Schmenge, and I'm Stan Schmenge, and tonight the happy wanderers salute the new wave music.
The Schmengies are not the only family duo on SCTV. The show's writing staff is full of brothers, wives, husbands, and various in-laws. It includes Joe Flaherty's brothers, Dave and Paul, Martin Short's brother, Michael, and Andrea Martin's husband, Bob. Further complicating matters is the fact that Andrea Martin's husband is also Martin Short's brother-in-law. Writer John McAndrew says the real humor of the show grows out of this big extended family.
It's a humanistic sense of humor, that's for sure. There's a love of show business, but a parody of cliché that's merciless. And show business and cliché, it's an illimitable field.
I'm Alabama bound. I've got no EBGB moving around.
Sketch 49, scene 22, shot 2, take 10, yep. Please.
SCTV has won Emmys for writing in each of the last 2 years. The writers and the actors say they will experiment more now that the show is on cable. In the 18 new episodes produced for Cinemax, viewers can look forward to more scary sneak previews on Monster Horror Chiller Theater, some phony Sophia Loren commercials, including one for Sophia's Muffler Shop, and a spoof of college jiggle movies called All Girls Private School Christmas Break.
Hey, everybody, I have an announcement. We're dropping All Girls...
Take two. Take two.
This is John Kalish.
And 4, 3...
And if the accordion version of Billie Jean is not quite to your liking, try this new music on for size.
Rapping is no longer just a slang term for talking. It's now a musical genre, a blend of street staccato and curbside poetry. Tom Vitale prepared this report.
We're the chiefs of relief, can tame a wild beast. The finesse of the West, the masterpiece of the East. The boss of cars, the lord of...
Rapping remained a local fad in the South Bronx and Harlem parks and nightclubs until 1979, when record producer Sylvia Robinson and her son Joey decided to make a rap record.
One night, me and my mother went to one of these clubs and we saw this. And we saw the reaction of the people. And we said we wanted to put it on vinyl. And people thought we were crazy when we did this at first. And Rap is the Light, and it was the biggest 12-inch ever in the record history.
Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. See, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say...
Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang sold over 2 million records as an album-sized single, and it opened the way for dozens of hit rap records to follow. Today, 21-year-old Joey Robinson keeps both of his Mercedes sports coupes parked outside his office at Sugar Hill Records in Englewood, New Jersey. Millie Mel writes and performs raps for Grandmaster Flash. Mel says the best raps are ones that move the listener through the power of a good rhyme.
Rapping is more of a direct communication than singing, you know, because it's talking. You know, some songs don't really have to say much or have, you know, any content in it. But it could still be a great song just by the value of the sound of the song. But rapping, it has a more potent effect when you use the right words.
Well, maybe you can give me an idea. Like, what's a good rhyme?
Well, the rhyme and the message, that's probably the best rhyme I wrote, is a child is born with no state of mind, blind to the ways of mankind. God is smiling on you, but he's frowning too, because only God knows what you'll go through.
You'll grow in the ghetto, living second rate, and your eyes will sing a song of deep hate. The places you play and where you stay looks like one great big alleyway. You'll admire...
In 1982, The Message by Millie Mel and Grandmaster Flash marked a turning point in the history of rap. The detailed description of ghetto life in this song elevated rapping from party music to poetry. Rapper Millie Mel.
One thing led to another, and then the message came, and then it was, you know, something different. Like, instead of just something to make somebody party, it was a more or less a form of communication where you can get a certain thought or a certain point across, whereas you couldn't, you know, a couple of years ago, because it was all about, you know, who you are and how good you can rap and how many girls you can pull, you know. It got into, you know, a little more in-depth into something like more or less poetry.
Sad song of how you live so fast and die so young. So don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
Rapping doesn't have to make any kind of social statement, and it doesn't have to grow out of the ghetto experience. According to Melly Mel, rapping is simply a rhyme set to music, and anyone can do it.
You know, Georgie Porgy Puddin' Pie kissed a girl and made him cry. That's a rhyme. That's rapping. If you say it, if you say that rhyme to music, it'll sound like rapping.
Little Miss Muffet sitting on her tuffet, listen to the music all day. Long come a spider, sit down beside her and rap her heart away.
Don't do it, you can talk rhythm,
I can talk and rhyme. Anyone be a rapper anytime. I am Master T, T-O-M, Vitali. One more line before I go. National Public Radio.
And one more rhyme, if you're not sick already. You can call me Carrie, just don't call me Betty. Anyway you shake it, this podcast's done. Thanks to the people who made it so much fun, like Spear and Katzip and my librarian friends. Okay, that's enough. This has got to end. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.